session, Judge Smith, Judge Hal Brooks, Judge Larkin. The Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning, please be seated. Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 14th, 2019. We have five cases on our oral calendar this morning, one non-oral. We'll begin with the first one, which is A18-0694, Lakmini Harath, petitioner, respondent versus Susanna Harath, appellant. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for argument, 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use it. Go ahead, take the podium. Adjust it as you need to, and then whenever you're ready, just state your name and a party you represent for the record.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jamie Driggs. This is Katie Graves, and we represent the appellant in this case, Susanna Harath. This case raises the question of what constitutes a dissipation of assets. Mr. Harath made a series of transfers totaling about $330,000during the course of the party's marriage to his brother, and these transfers were made without Ms. Harath's consent. But under our dissipation statute, lack of
knowledge.
Correct. Under our dissipation statute, lack of consent is just one element. And so it's not enough to show lack of consent. To show dissipation, you have to show that the disposal of assets occurred either while a divorce case was pending or in contemplation of commencing a divorce. And that's the key. And that makes sense because it's common in marriages for somebody to be in the dark and one spouse to be managing finances, things like that. And in fact, it's disagreements about those sorts of issues that may well lead to the divorce in the first place. So it makes a lot of sense to show or to require a proponent of a claim to show that the person transferring funds was acting in contemplation of divorce. Because the whole point of our dissipation doctrine is to prevent parties from subverting the process of the court. This is what the Supreme Court said in the Bollenbach case. The whole point is to prevent someone from taking advantage of their spouse by reducing the assets that are available to be divided in the divorce. And so that's what our dissipation statute is designed to prevent. And this is where the trial court's finding of dissipation is clearly erroneous, because the transfers of assets in this case occurred over a 15-year period of time, 15 years, from 2002 to 2016. And so without knowing anything more than that, that time period alone ought to give this court pause, because that's a really long period of time to believe that somebody was unhappily married and then pursuing some scheme to take advantage of their spouse in a divorce 15 years later. That's just really difficult to believe. And the trials.
Mr. Griggs, just to pin down the chronology, I'm trying to skim the order and not finding it, but isn't there something in the record to the effect that the appellant made a statement that he was contemplating divorce or considering divorce back in about 2001?
That's correct, Your Honor. He admitted during his deposition that he thought about divorce in 2001 or 2002. He also admitted that he had met with a divorce attorney at some point in 2009 or 2010.
And how would that impact your argument that that's a clearly erroneous finding then?
Well, the reason it's clearly erroneous is because just the fact that the idea of divorce enters your mind, that doesn't mean that everything you do after that point in time is done to try to cheat your spouse in a divorce. And just because, and look at the passage of time. I mean, he admitted, well, I thought about getting divorced. Well, he didn't meet with a divorce attorney until 7 or 8 years later. So he obviously wasn't very serious about getting divorced. And the passage of time between meeting with a divorce attorney and actually having the case started, again, we're talking about years here. So you can't just say because you're married and, you know, he testified and was honest that he had thought about a divorce, that doesn't mean that everything you're doing after that point in time is done for the purpose of cheating your spouse. And And that was just pure speculation on the trial court's part.
Why was he making all these transfers?
He was making these transfers, Your Honor, to repay monies to his brother that had been loaned, and there's various financial transactions. And the court found that there was lots of transactions and joint ventures, excuse me, where the brothers were working together on things. And I'll get to that.
Did he document any outstanding debts that he was repaying and present that information to the court?
Your Honor, there is a listing of debts that he did present to the court. The trial court found that the documentation that he presented was not adequate, and the trial court wasn't persuaded by his testimony. I want to be clear about that. But the whole point here is that it was Ms. Harrath who had the burden of proof on this issue to prove dissipation. And let's not forget that it was Ms. Harrath who started the divorce. So to affirm the trial court, you have to believe a pretty bizarre set of facts. You have to believe that in 2002, after being married for 9 years, Mr. Harrath decided he wanted to get divorced. And so he comes up with this scheme where he says, I know just what I'll do. I'm going to stay married. I'm going to continue to work. I'm going to continue to earn income. I'm going to continue to build wealth. I'm going to continue to build up my retirement assets. I'm going to continue to support my spouse. And I'm just going to transfer some money along the way to my brother, because someday, in the event of a divorce, I'll be able to then really take advantage of her. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. Somebody who...
That argument seems to be that the only logical thing is you dissipate all assets or none. Like, why couldn't it be that he decided to protect, from his perspective, dissipate from hers some assets?
Well, because...
Contemplation of that they will be getting divorced at some time.
The passage of time, Your Honor, I mean, if you look at the passage of time, we're talking about 15 years. 15 years. They were married for 9 years. So it really belies common sense to believe that somebody would then, after being married for 9 years, decide they want to get divorced and then just wait around for longer than the marriage for their spouse to someday start the divorce, so that they can take advantage. That just doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's a really, really long period of time to be acting in contemplation of divorce with this plan to take advantage. I mean, that's really what the statute is getting at. It's talking about people who are engaged in divorce planning, that they're trying to shortchange their spouse by reducing the assets that are available for division. And it just doesn't make any sense that somebody who is unhappily married after 9 years would then spend the next 15 years in some elaborate scheme that they think that they're going to somehow come out ahead. That just doesn't make sense. Because remember, he's the one who's earning the income here. She's the dependent spouse. He's the one working and building wealth and accumulating assets. And nobody who comes to the conclusion that they want to get divorced and they don't want to pay their spouse anything, nobody's going to stay married and just continue to work and earn income and have that be their plan. That just doesn't make any sense.
One difficulty, of course, I'm sure you recognize, you've referenced it, is the district court, I mean, specifically said that he did not find the trial testimony of your client or his brother to be persuasive with respect to this. And I'm sure the same argument was asserted to
right.
the district court. So you've got this adverse credibility finding.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, it comes down to the burden of proof here. It wasn't Mr. Harrath who had the burden to show that he was not dissipating assets. It was Ms. Harrath's burden to show that Mr. Harrath was dissipating assets. And it was her burden to prove that. It wasn't his burden. And if you think about what happened here, he was asked to come up with documentation going back a decade and a half. I mean, the fact that he didn't have documents to support every transaction that we're talking about isn't surprising at all. I mean, people don't keep records like that. And so, again, it boils down to a burden of proof issue, because it was Ms. Harrath's burden to show that Mr. Harrath was dissipating assets, not the other way around. And it doesn't make any sense that somebody in that position would spend 15 years waiting for their spouse to one day start the divorce. And Ms. Harrath points out in her brief, well, there's nothing in the dissipation statute that says that it has to be the other party who starts the divorce. And that's true, but that's a significant fact here. It wasn't like he started the divorce. And there just isn't any case law that picks up a time frame anywhere in the ballpark of what we're talking about here. 15 years is a really long period of time. And if that's dissipation, you can have dissipation claims all over the place, because people can go back all the time in divorce and look back and say, well, gee, I don't like the way that this money got spent. I didn't know this was happening. Well, it's not enough to show that somebody didn't have knowledge or somebody didn't have consent. You have to show that this was part of a plan. This was, you were contemplating divorce, that the divorce was going to happen, and you're trying to gain some unfair advantage by reducing the assets that were available for division to take advantage of your spouse. And that's where the court got it wrong here, because sure, there were transfers of assets that were happening. It was done without Ms. Harrath's consent. But again, this was something that was done throughout the party's marriage, because the trial court found that Mr. Harrath and his brothers intermingled funds. And that's the other part of this that the court got wrong, is that another element of a dissipation claim is you have to show that the transfers were not in the usual course of business.
There was a finding, though, it's in a footnote in the amended order, that there were inconsistencies. Your client and the respondent were required to pay rent to one of the brothers in a comparable circumstance. Another family member was not. I mean, it seemed as if there were things the district court focused on that.
Well, that's not dissipation, though. I mean, maybe that's not fair, but that's not dissipation, just because there's some double standard among family members.
No, but it can serve to create a sense of, incredibility of the explanation.
Well, again, the problem here is that the trial court found that it made inconsistent findings, because it found on the one hand, respondent and his brothers shared and intermingled funds and investments in real estate, and they also worked together on ventures such as the Harrath Foundation. The evidence indicated that throughout these dealings, the family presented various reasons for ownership of assets and appeared to transfer funds between them as necessary to suit each other's interests and purposes. This was something that the trial court found was routine. Sure, it was sloppy, it was messy, but it went on for 15 years. So the trial court's finding that on the one hand, this was going on between the brothers all the time, but yet this was not in the usual course of business, is internally inconsistent. I mean, that's the problem here, is that there is a whole lot of transfers of funds happening between the brothers, and this went on for a decade and a half, and the trial court just said, well, this is all dissipation. And you can't have it both ways. You can't say on the one hand, this was the norm for this family during their marriage, and on the other hand, this was something that he was doing outside of the normal course of business, and he's doing that in contemplation of divorce to take advantage of his spouse. And that's why this finding is clearly erroneous. And that sort of leads to the other problem, which is one of double counting, because it treated all of the transfers of funds to Mr. Harrath's brother as dissipation, but it also decided that there was a marital interest in this property at 1605 25th Street in St. Cloud. And so it counted those dollars twice, because every single dollar that was transferred to Mr. Harrath's brother was treated as dissipation, and yet there also was a value placed on this property. So there's a double counting issue there. So for all of those reasons.
For which property again?
The 1605 property. Mm-hmm. And so for all of those reasons, the dissipation finding is clearly erroneous, and we're asking that it be reversed. The other issue I'd like to touch on is the property distribution plan that the trial court issued, because Mr. Harrath doesn't have any way to comply with that because he wasn't awarded any liquid assets. He was awarded retirement assets and real estate, and he couldn't pay anything without incurring taxes and commissions and penalties and things like that, none of which was accounted for. And the trial court also didn't make any finding about his net income, his after-tax income. And so there's no, he doesn't have the ability to comply with this plan, and that was an abuse of discretion. And that same error, not making a finding about what Mr. Harrath's after-tax income is also a reason why the trial court abused its discretion in awarding spousal maintenance, because it didn't really look at his ability to pay maintenance, because it didn't find how much money he has after paying income taxes.
What evidence was there on that question?
There were three paycheck stubs that showed his gross income and his net income, and there were 5 years of income tax returns. And that was all part of the evidence that was that was admitted. So the trial court had a way to make that finding. And I'm out of time.
And did you identify in your brief what his net income is based on the evidence that was in the record? I don't remember seeing that. So there's an argument it should have found it and in reference to something in the record, but then what is it that the district court missed? What is the net income?
We didn't make
if it's ascertainable from the record.
We didn't make a calculation of net income in our brief, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the trial court didn't, the issue here is the trial court didn't attempt to make a determination of net income. I mean, it didn't find.
Was it supposed to, you didn't calculate it in your brief. Was the district court supposed to calculate it from those documents, or was there actually a net income that was produced to the court based on documents?
Well, the trial court was presented with the evidence to make that net income calculation because it had the tax returns and it had the paycheck stubs. It didn't try to do that because if you look at the finding, it didn't say, well, gee, I didn't have enough information to be able to make this determination. It simply didn't do that. It just made a finding of his gross income and then didn't take it any step further from there.
Okay. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Farhan Hassan. This is Courtney Latcham. We represent Ms. Harrath in this matter. Your Honor, in looking at the context of this case, what I want to make sure this court is aware of is the appellant's district court position, the trial position, versus the position that he takes today. And that will provide this court with the appropriate context. I want to talk about his trial position briefly. It was, when it was all said and done, after 23 years of marriage, after having raised two kids who then were in college, my client was left with $7,400 in change in her name. That's a fact. Dr. Harrath, on the other hand, had $900 and some thousand in his asset list in terms of who had ownership. Of course, we know ownership does not matter. Of course, we also know that both spouses are conclusively presumed to have contributed to the marriage, and that's the issue here. So when Dr. Harrath presented his case in trial court, his presentation was, and I want to be very clear about this, my wife of 23 years has no interest in real estate. That was his position. It is not his position today. Number two, his position was she has no ownership or right to the cash that I transferred without telling her, without her knowledge. Fact. Number three, I was paying debt. That's why I transferred it. And to answer Your Honor's question, he had six different explanations of the dollar amounts ranging from October of 2015 through the trial date of 2000 and 17. Six different explanations. That's the context of this case. The intent of the spousal maintenance statute, just an equitable division, the reason we have prenuptial agreements and strict procedural requirements, the reason we have postnuptial agreements, the reason we have a just and equitable division of property, when one person like my client may be at home taking care of two minor children and helping the other parent increase their career opportunities and make income, to his credit, make income, is so that when it all comes to an end, if it does, they both walk away fair. They're compensated. And that's the essence of this case. And I do want this court to be very aware of that context, that the positions that this appellant took on the day of trial and leading up to the trial and his testimony at trial and his deposition, two sworn testimonies, is very, very different from what he presents before you today. And that's one of the critical pieces here. Let me address dissipation. We believe we have fulfilled our burden to a T. We have no consent. We have no knowledge on my client's part. We have transfers. We have commencement in contemplation of divorce. I have sworn testimony, not once, twice. Under both occasions, he admitted that he actually thought about divorce as early as 1993. Because he thought...
What does the statute mean when it says, in contemplation of commencing the current dissolution proceeding? How do you square that with a time frame?
Your Honor, in my humble opinion, the reading is of the statute is that it focuses on the actions of a party, the intent of a party. Why is a party doing certain things? And here the certain things are, why is Dr. Harrath transferring $361,000? By the way, it's not $330,000, it's $361,000. Why is he doing that? And that, Your Honor, is he is doing that in contemplation of divorce. So that's my reading of it. And I believe it is very consistent with the Rizvi case, where the husband in that case transferred 22 months prior to commencement and 44 months prior to commencement. The statute absolutely imposes no time frame. It's a case-by-case inquiry. And let's talk further about this. I will submit to this court that if there was an explanation, Dr. Harrath was provided plenty of opportunities to provide an explanation of what he did and why he did it. And let me address that. We had deposits, always deposits, transfers going from my client's money, Dr. Harrath's account, to his brother's. We had not one deposit coming in. That's a fact. We had them paying rent for 15 years while Dr. Harrath makes $191,000 and is a tenured professor at St. Cloud State University. And he does not have ownership in real estate. That's his position. We had a rental property that he did not have his wife on the account, on the title. His brother was on the title. We had a line of credit that was fully paid off in February of 2015 prior to the commencement of the proceeding. Fully paid off. In May of 2015, just 3 months later, it's now fully encumbered. Line of credit was $172,000. These are all facts. And the trial court knew it. And frankly, in my opinion, the trial court was more than generous in this case to Dr. Harrath. I believe that the court gave him plenty of opportunities. We even have the trial court leaving the record open after the trial concluded so that he could even submit more information because the record provided to the court was so deficient, Your Honors. That's the whole point here. So my response is A, there is no time frame requirement. There is no requirement that my client could not commence a divorce proceeding and that only he could. That's not the issue. There is no law that suggests that you cannot plan a scheme for X number of years. That's exactly what this was, and that's exactly what the trial court found, who is in charge of credibility determinations. And then let's talk about what is the end result that appellant is seeking. The result he is actually seeking, if you were to buy that theory, is my client gets nothing. His trial position was he has no interest in real estate. His trial position was the cash is gone, I'm paying my debt. I don't know what debt, but he was paying his debt. So in the end, his position is my client gets zero. And then the only thing that he said my client was entitled to was retirement. And even that, he testified, she shouldn't get 50% because she didn't earn it. That's the context here, Your Honors. That's what we're talking about here.
Can you address the question of double counting the dissipation plus the 1605 property marital interest?
Absolutely, Your Honors. First of all, the presumption is that anything that exists inside the marriage, earned during the marriage, is presumed to be marital property. That's the presumption. Then if the issue is that that money should not be counted, the burden is on the party who's saying it should not be counted. And that's where all of the explanations that I gave about how these explanations made no sense matters. In other words, there was no evidence presented, no rational evidence presented to the trial court for the court to be even able to say, yes, you transferred X amount of dollars so that you could buy property.
So is the link between the dollars and the property, you're saying that's missing?
That is exactly right, Your Honor. And not only is it missing, the appellant testified before the trial court that he had no ownership in that home. So the same home that he now today says, I was paying money, you're double counting, his trial court testimony never reflected that, at least with the level of conviction that you're hearing about it today.
But the court did find ownership.
Absolutely.
Right. So what he testified to maybe is not relevant to whether there's an error.
Yes.
Right, in double counting.
Yes.
And
yes,
you're saying that the reason there's not an error is because there's not a connection that's established between the dissipated funds and the property.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. Counsel used the word shortchange, and in closing on the dissipation issue, Your Honor, that's exactly what they're seeking. If you were to buy their theory that they're proposing today, and by the way, that was already proposed before the trial court, that's exactly where my client is. She is shortchanged after 23 years of marriage.
Could you address the issue of net income and absence of findings on what net income was?
Yes, Your Honor. So first of all, appellant did not provide even evidence of his gross income. That's the starting point here. He did not provide his 2016 W-2. The trial occurs in February of 2017. His W-2 was available. The court made specific findings that he did not provide it. That's number one. Number two, the appellant did not provide a year-to-date pay stub for December, showing all of his gross income. So you have a situation where the complaint is the court, the trial court, should have done something that they did not even provide evidence of. That's the issue here, which is why all of the cases that appellant cites are not applicable. They're all cases where people go about it the right way. They go to a trial court, and they have a legitimate difference of opinion, and they are both saying, take my proposal over this proposal. That's not what happened here. You have a situation where he did not even provide his gross income. Third point, Your Honor, he did not even provide rental income.
Can I just ask before you get to that, what about the income tax returns that were submitted, the 5 years of income tax returns? That didn't show the gross, that was not sufficient to show net income then? Or why isn't that evidence of?
Your Honor, because the I think the court could have done that. The court could have looked at income tax returns for previous years, but the court has to make a determination for spousal maintenance purposes for current income and current expenses. And so
What years were the tax returns that were submitted?
You know, I believe, I'm not sure about this, but I believe it was 2011 through 2015.
Okay.
And I will also note, with respect to the net income issue, just practically speaking, my client did provide a FinPlan calculation, which was tendered into exhibits, so that was available. The court made specific findings about gross income, and practically speaking, we are left with Dr. Harath earning $191,000 per year that the court found, and my client earning $24,000 in change per year. Practically speaking, the court looked at the expenses, reduced them, then said, I will order $1,800 in change for spousal maintenance. So practically speaking, where it is fatal or could have been fatal is where the two spouses have to share the pain. The person does not have the ability to pay. That was not even an issue here. This is what Dr. Harath submitted in his expenses, $1,000 for research reimbursement, $3,600 for private school, for school tuition for his adult kids, over and beyond his wife.
These were the items that were rejected by the district court.
That's right.
In his expenses.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Charitable contributions of $1,000. $1,500 for attorney's fees. And so when I totaled up the expenses that the court rejected, that alone was $8,000 of expenses that he was saying that were supposedly appropriate. So my position, Your Honor, is we did provide the court with net income. The court had to go through a lot of trouble to even find gross income of Dr. Harath, not because of us, but because of him. And Dr. Harath did not even provide evidence of his rental income. There were two rental properties. One was even advertised for rent for $2,500 per month in New Jersey. No evidence. By the way, both properties fully paid off. If anything,
owned with siblings.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, only siblings. Not my client. And the court did find that that my client had a share in it, rightfully so. Your Honor, I'm out of time. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to just point out that there are pay stubs that are in the record, and I would point the court to Exhibit 99, which is a paycheck for my client that was issued on November 23rd, 2016, and it very clearly lists gross income and net income. So that information was available to the court.
Do you have any complaint about the gross income? The number of the gross income. I understand your complaint about that's not the relevant number, but do you have any objection to the amount found for gross?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Is it just his salary? Is there any other contribution to gross income besides salary?
I believe it's just that.
Okay.
So the issue with respect to net income is that the court has to make a determination of a spousal maintenance obligor's ability to pay.
Did you propose a finding regarding net income for the district court to consider?
I believe so, Your Honor. I don't have that right in front of me. I believe so. Mm-hmm. The issue here, though, is that the court has to make a finding of net income every time spousal maintenance is ordered.
Is that are those the trial exhibits?
These are the trial exhibits.
And buried in there is a pay stub.
Well, there are four pay stubs,
Four pay stubs. That's probably a foot worth of document.
It is, Your Honor.
And we don't even know that counsel for husband proposed a net income finding for the district court, yet the complaint is the district court did not extrapolate from that pile his net income.
Well, these are trial exhibits that were introduced.
Understood.
And these were Ms. Harrath's trial exhibits, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I do think that the court had that information. I don't think it was finding a needle in a haystack. That's an obligation that a trial court has to do in every single case. And again, I would direct the court to the findings that the trial court made. The finding was not, I don't have sufficient evidence to be able to make this determination. There's just no indication whatsoever that the trial court made any attempt or was aware of determining Mr. Harrath's ability to pay. It didn't try.
You would agree there was no evidence submitted with respect to rental income?
That wasn't something that the trial court made a finding about. That wasn't part of Mr. Harrath's income.
I'm looking at page 4 of the first order. It said the court finds respondent failed to provide any information related to rental income, this is finding number 17, earned by properties in St. Cloud on 25th Street and Mays Landing, New Jersey. And such rental income may have been offset by rental expenses.
But the trial court didn't find that that was part of Mr. Harrath's income. I mean, it didn't impute any income to him from that.
Well, that's because it had no information. Isn't that a fair reading of the finding?
I think you could read it that way, but the way that I would read it is that the trial court wasn't persuaded that that would have been appropriate at all. I mean, one of the things...
Right after that, it says, Mr. Griggs, therefore, the court will use $15,995 as respondent's gross monthly income for the calculation of spousal maintenance. So it seemed to be involved in the calculation if it had been available.
Well, I don't think that the trial court was relying on that because it didn't make any finding to the effect that because we're going to assume some level of rental income and therefore that gives him the ability to pay. There is no finding to that effect at all. So I think that would just be a guess if that's what this court would assume. I don't think that that's a fair reading of all of that. I want to clarify one point, which is the reason the trial court left the record open is not because Mr. Harrath didn't present enough evidence. There was a dispute about the valuation date, and the trial court left the record open and directed both parties to submit evidence of account statements and things so that it had consistent values as of the date that it selected. This wasn't some open invitation to present all sorts of new evidence on whatever topics you want to present. So I think that's a really important point to clarify because counsel keeps arguing that this is a sign that Mr. Harrath was being disingenuous, and that's not accurate. Thank you.
Thank you both. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time frame. Thanks. Our next case this morning is A18-1176, State of Minnesota versus Michael Peter Derevitsky.